Hello, welcome to Encounter. I'm Margaret Coffey. This week, an encounter with Indonesia's Islam. There's a narrow, bannered alley in the city of Surabaya. It's in the old part of the city where the poor congregate, away from the commercial glitz of new Surabaya. There's a distinctly Middle Eastern air. The alley is in the Arab quarter. Every year, thousands of pilgrims walk this way to visit the grave of a saint. Now, that's something Orthodox Islam doesn't go in for.
What can I do for you?
You speak English?
Yes, Elijah, no.
Can you tell me about this mosque?
Yes, the mosque from Sunan Anfal. Its name is Sunan Anfal, from Saudi Arabia. You came here explaining religious Islam. Yeah.
Sunan Anfal was one of the Wali Songo, the nine saints credited with bringing Islam to Indonesia. It said Sunan Anfal converted the first great Islamic kingdom on Java. But you can understand at his grave that it was a conversion on Javanese terms.
For women, yeah. For men, yeah. Okay.
I take my shoes off.
Yeah.
Oh.
No.
Islam came to Indonesia 700 years ago from India and the Middle East. Those influences are felt today in diverse ways. But Indonesian Muslims have made out of their historical and cultural circumstances a distinctive Islam.
Tolong jangan sampai terlalu masuk. Sepat sandalnya sudah masuk. Oh ya. Nanti jangan terlalu masuk ke sana.
Iya, benar, Pak. Saya juga. Terima kasih banyak, Pak.
Di spandu yang baik.
Oke, iya, benar.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, friend. For serenity, security from here.
In Surabaya, at the grave of Sunan Anfal, there is the distinctiveness and the burden of tradition. In Jakarta, in a very smart suburb, there's the distinctiveness and the burden of modernity. Paramedina is an Islamic educational organisation focused on Jakarta's growing middle class. It runs courses, publishes books, sponsors discussion groups. Its quarters are in a shopping strip behind McDonald's.
Attendant or student, say student of Paramedina, of Paramedina Society, almost coming from the middle class, and they got good education, and some of them are Western educated. But they feel that they need intellectual justification of their being Muslim. We always introduce and invite them first to come to the substance of Quran. We introduce first philosophical understanding of Islam, and second mystical understanding of Islam, and third we also try to understand Islam contextually. So we need sociological and historical approach to Islam.
It's Saturday, lunchtime, students are arriving. The afternoon course is on the Tao of Islam.
Why have you come to Paramedina?
I've been joining Paramedina for 7 years, and I feel that my knowledge about Islam still not enough, so this is the place that I can get knowledge about Islam more, and postmodern Islam, that we are very moderate, tolerate, and etc.
You're a doctor, I'm told, a gynecologist.
Yeah, yeah.
Why are you here at Paramedina?
Because I'm retired now. I'm retired and I have a lot of time to study. Formerly, I used to learn at traditional Islam tradition. But now I have a lot of time. I study here to seek the rational thinking of Islam.
I look at Islam as a complete surrender towards the God. Most of the Muslims, we are delayed in learning our own religion. Take my example. I never studied Islam when I was young, when I was studying. I study medical, but at this present, we think we have to do something just for the sake of our offsprings, our children. I don't know whether this has to do something with politics. I think maybe, yeah. Yeah? Yeah?
Terima kasih. Wassalamualaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh.
Here's a third image of Islam in Indonesia. We've had tradition and modernity, now there's politics. In the week of Muhammad's birthday, there was a national Quranic recitation competition. The finals were broadcast live, simultaneously on three channels in prime evening viewing time. There were long speeches. This one thanked the sponsors. And very long lists of prize winners. Every spot in the archipelago took home an award. Where does Gusdur live?
Half an hour at least from now.
In Indonesia, I wanted to hear young people, emerging leaders. But the chance to meet Abdurrahman Wahid was too good to pass up. He's the leader of NU, Nakhbatul Ulama, the largest Islamic organization in the country, with 30 million members. Abdurrahman Wahid is a national figure. There's no one remotely like him in Australia.
President's reach.
Well, of course, you know, for the right Quranic reciting, you know, I could cry. I know the meaning when the sound is right, the voice is right, and so forth. But to make it being competed for is something outside my understanding, you know. How could you, for example, making a competition of preaches? That's I don't understand why.
But it was also compulsorily broadcast on three channels.
Oh, yes. That's because this is what left for the government to do, to placate the Muslims, to show that it has interest in Islam and so forth. It does that with much cost. Sometimes, not sometimes, nearly always, the winner in this category, representing province of Jambi, for example, came from Jogja, you know. He or she was hired. Crazy, how could they do that?
Yeah, and this is his house, this is the mosque.
NU is strictly a religious, social and educational organization. Years ago, it was a political party, but now it's not. Its leader has even refused membership of ICHMI. That's the Association of Islamic Intellectuals established in 1990 under the government's sponsorship, partly to ensure that Islamic values are reflected in public policy. Historically, NU had a rural base, and its origins in 1926 lie in traditionalist defence of Javanese Islam.
I respect those Rasis, yeah? Those Rasis or gurus. I consult them, and when they ask me to do this tirakat, not tarekat. Tirakat means refraining from doing something, you know? So when they ask me to do the fasting, or this, I do that. I know that it's not ordered by Islam, but I think it's important for my life, you know? For example, they will say that, for certain days you have to avoid, doing this or that, you know. So I follow. Why? Because in my commonsensical approach to life is that if I don't do those things, I lose nothing, you see. But if what they see as bad premonition takes place, you see, I will lose. So that's, it's better to avoid losing something. So this is a kind of a spiritual belief which has no connection at all with the religion, but of course has origin in our belief that God regulates life in so much complexity.
Abdurrahman Wahid directs you away from simplicities. The power elite versus the masses, liberals versus fundamentalists, Muslims versus Christians. At every level, Indonesian society has many faces, he says. The word he uses, prismatic.
The middle class prismatic, the lower class prismatic, the bureaucracy prismatic, the military prismatic, all are divided. You can see in the military, for example, those who would like to, you know, to develop professionalism. On the other side, you have soldiers such as Faisal Tanjung, who would like to promote the interest of Islam in the armed forces. You can see also that this happens in the bureaucracy. And in the middle class, you have the same thing. See the division between the so rich and not so rich, those who depend on the government and those who don't, those who would like to promote, you know, Islam and secular people. Maybe the non-prismatic stratum will be the lower class. I mean, they don't care, you see. They are, if they are Muslims, they are Muslims. If they are, you know, Christians, they are Christians. But they share the same faith. We can say that the place of Islam actually is in every strata, all strata of the society. It becomes, you know, either a cultural force to find self-identity, to express their existence in the sense of being religious communities, for example. But on the other hand, there are Muslims who would like to express Islam in terms of power, in terms of acquiring, you know, domination of political institutions, of a group to resist the what they call as the domination of the Chinese and non-Muslims.
In Yogyakarta, I went to the mosque for the 12 o'clock prayer. It was a poor man's mosque, a place for betjak drivers, the underpaid. For many poor people, Islam is a means of expression.
I think there is no special or specific reason for that. It's just that the poor has no thing to express their existence or their wishes, yeah, with. I mean, you look at the ideology, it's already co-opted by the state. You look at, culture. Cultural expressions as such now is being so commercialized that nothing can be done to express their true feelings. So the only open way is through religion. Poor people always see Islam as a way of life. They try to implement Islamic teachings voluntarily. They follow their leaders at the local level, and then they also associate with fellow religionists to, you know, to have activities, yeah, mainly local activities. In itself, there is something healthy, but sometimes when you are agitated by the widening gap between the rich and the poor, so if there are firebrands who would say that the Muslims are the poor and the non-Muslims are the rich, the Chinese are the main culprit behind their very sad state, as natives they have to regain their rights, then the expression used is also Islam. But I think it's only temporarily and only in special cases where there are people who incite their emotions. Otherwise, no.
I am the only woman that often come to this mosque every 5 times for praying.
Tell me why.
Because maybe I'm looking for the truth. And I want to be most closer to the God that I believe Islam is the last and the truth of the faith in this world. And I will show to the world that this is the really faith, the really truth that people would like to look for to solve the problem of the world. I believe, I really believe, but I cannot prove because I don't have the science, the knowledge to tell to the people, but I really believe that Islam is really, really the faith, the truth that must be.
This woman lives in the kampung alongside the mosque. She wears the veil and the long gown of traditional Islam. Her mother was a widow who supported 8 children. In Indonesia, there's no social security as in Australia, and unemployment is very high.
I hope that I can live in, after the doomsday, live happily ever after. Because it's a God's promise that He will give a nice place for the people who can be a good Muslim. I want to be a good Muslim.
Main debate now is about the type of society we would like to build. On the other hand, people like, on one hand, people like Amin Rais and so forth, the chairman of Muhammadiyah, always reiterate that we should build an Islamic society in Indonesia, in which the Muslims implement the teachings of the religion in a collective way, although it's not an Islamic state. But for people like myself, it's something very, very, very frightening. Because if we still retain the idea of creating or building or developing an Islamic society, that would mean we would use teachings of Islam as the formal rule or the main rule for the society. We should legislate Islamic laws then. We should, shape our educational system into an Islamic one. But of course, this is against the Constitution. This is against the very idea of the Republic of Indonesia. So people from myself, like myself, reject this kind of society. Would like to see a modern Indonesian society where the Muslims would implement the teachings of the religion voluntarily and, let's say, individually. Even they act in a collective way, but that will be an individual decision to join or not. So this is basically the issue.
We're a group of supplicants in Amin Rais's waiting room. A town in central Java needs a new school building. Another wants a hospital. He's invited to give a speech. You heard the name Amin Rais. He's head of the other large Islamic organization in Indonesia, Muhammadiyah. 15 million strong, Muhammadiyah's membership grew out of the towns and a modernist, reformist outlook.
I think there was a process of mutual learning between the government and the Islamic Ummah, or the Muslim majority. The government, I think, finally realized that the Muslims as majority cannot be discounted, you know. I mean, the role of the majority in the national development process is very substantive and very significant, you know. But also, I think the Muslim leaders came to realize that it is just impossible, you know, to establish an Islamic state in the pluralistic society like Indonesia. We have to respect other people's religion, we have to respect other people's aspiration, you know. And the Muslims now, I think, can accept very, very sincerely what's going on in the political scene, you know, because the Muslims now do not feel neglected and discounted anymore, you know. So in this process, I see a very positive future. And now we have accepted Pancasila as our sole national ideology, you know. There is no controversy any longer. I think this is also good, you know. So we can start afresh, you know, to build our future, and we can put behind our ideological conflict, which is very time-consuming and energy-consuming.
President Suharto has invited Amin Rais to rest. He's no longer a member of ICHMI, that government-sponsored organization of Islamic intellectuals that has assumed so much symbolic importance.
That gentleman, who is the most important guy in my country, asked Habibi, you know, to tell me that my criticism is already beyond the limits of tolerance, you know, and then something must be done, you know. And then he told Mr. Habibi that as a chairman of Muhammadiyah and one of very important functionaries of ICHMI, my criticisms will be very influential, you know. Many segments of the Indonesian society will believe my criticism, you know, and then it can, to some extent, destabilize, you know, the political stability. Basically, I launched my criticism against corruption and collusion, and then I remind the government of the blunt fact that there is a widening gap, a yawning gap between the rich and the poor, you know. Finally, I also said again and again that the bottom line reason of the recent political explosions, social explosions in Java and the other islands is the social gap, you know. I didn't buy any theory which says that the political disturbances, the social turmoils in different towns in Indonesia was caused by ethnic discrimination or religious conflict, you know. I think these are only superficial issues, you know. Many, many people in my country feel that the social injustice in this country cannot be tolerated any longer and it must be redressed, you know. So probably some of my expressions hurt the feeling of the old guy, you know.
Strong criticism from intensely Islamic quarters does tend still to disturb. Sri Bintang Pamungkas is an economist, a believer in ICHMI as an avenue for Muslims to political power, and a proponent of a true Islamic political party as a means to achieving greater democracy. He was expelled from the legal Muslim political party, and now he's in jail. Can you tell me first why your husband is in jail?
Dia dituduh menghina presiden.
He's been charged for insulting the president when he was giving a seminar in Germany. He was actually bringing the topic of 10 economic problems in Indonesia, but he was charged for insulting the president.
For people like Sri Bintang Pamungkas and Amin Rais, true democracy and justice
has a lot to do with strictly proportional representation.
It is true that I never conceal my belief that Islam in this country must be represented representatively. I mean, must be given a fair, honest, and just representation. Because Islam makes 88% of the whole nation, and then it is quite fair and just if in the parliaments, Islam is also given about 85 to 80% of the representation, you know. Why? Because I have a moral conviction, even religious belief, that a stable, a peaceful, a harmonious nation can be achieved only if we establish justice in the real sense of the word.
There's a certain kind of middle-class Muslim who is less inclined to blunt criticism of the state. The editor of the weekly Umat magazine, Shafi Anwar, says the criticism Umat goes in for is inclusive, moderate, loyal criticism. Umat is the third-ranking current affairs magazine after Gatra and Forum.
Sherry, this is actually a book review, written by Dawam Raharjo, about Islam politics and modernization.
Lidl is a very well-known scholar of Indonesian Islam.
I think he is one of the best Indonesianists in the United States. According to Lidl, Suharto actually has perception that there is faction from the army against his policy towards the development of Islam, etc. It means that actually Suharto wants to make a balance, power balance in Indonesian politics. And that's a little opinion. I do agree with Lidl that, of course, Suharto make his policy towards ICMI is because he want to make a power balance. Yeah? Okay, but I think that's not determinant factor. Probably the main problem.
President Suharto's sentiments aside, Islam has come inevitably into the political light, says Shafi Anwar. The important factor is the rise of an Islamic middle class that relishes modernity. These are the people who put together words like Islam, science, technology, almost as a mantra.
Yeah, imagine. I just make a comparison between the period of 1980 until now. And now it's a remarkable development of Islam. Why? Because they are very concerned about cyberspace world. Because they are very concerned about the news. Very concerned about the development of world itself. They have some heroes such as Mahathir Muhammad, such as Anwar Ibrahim, and other Islamic prominent leaders in the world. Yeah, and very, very, very respective to what the development of science and technology.
The heroes Shafi Anwar mentions are the Malaysian Prime Minister and Deputy Prime Minister.
I would like to introduce this Managing Editor, Ahmed Bashaib.
Hello.
This is my first coffee from...
In a certain way, Umat is daring. It essays contemporary issues to do with fiqh, for example, the interpretations of Islamic law which regulate daily life.
Special attention to
Umat. I don't know.
So you have a special page which discusses fiqh or law and the interpretation of it.
Yeah. Because most of fiqh law is formulated in the 12th or 13th century.
So the task is very much to look at the context in which fiqh was formulated and to reformulate it for the contemporary context.
Yes. Yeah.
What was last week's focus in that page? Or what's this week's focus? What's the coming fiqh focus?
The question is the marriage of a man who suffer from AIDS, okay? Yeah, according to one source, I mean one ulama said that their marriage is prohibited from the Islamic perspective or from the Islamic law, from the fiqh, yeah? Okay, but another perspective, I mean another ulama or Islamic preacher said that their marriage is permitted.
There is another kind of daring in the clarity of this sort of analysis.
The main problem of this country is first the gap between the rich and the poor, certainly, especially in terms of Chinese ethnics.
Does it translate into a religious problem?
No. I think it's the problem is wholly economical. You know that the news more spread in this archipelago that the amount of the Chinese ethnics in this country is just 3 to 4% of the total population, but they have maybe 70 to 80% of national economy. That's a blatant problem. They have a collusion, yeah, with the military elite, with the bureaucracy in this country, but they are elite, not in level of the masses.
How do you propose dealing with this problem?
The Malaysia model can be adopted by the government here. It must be some kind of discrimination in terms of allocation of the fund from the government bank. The Chinese groups in this country have lived in this country for hundreds of years, you know? It's impossible to impose them to out of this country as some people in this country want to, you know?
Many of them are also Muslim.
No, it's insignificant. Chinese group, maybe 7 million people in this country. And the Muslim part is just maybe hundred. Insignificant.
Indonesia's second richest man is a Chinese Muslim, isn't he? Muhammad Bob Hasan.
Yeah. But you know, frankly speaking, I think the majority of people in this country see Bob Hasan primarily as a Chinese, not a Muslim. You know, especially with his very powerful tie with the president. You know, Muslims in this country, the majority of Muslims, is not proud of him just because he's a Muslim. You know? Yeah, people see him as a corrupted man.
In our group, we do not reject Chinese. We do not reject anyone who wants to live in Indonesia. We see them as equal as us. This is our Islam opinion, Islamic opinion in LKIS.
Now here is emerging leadership. LKIS is an institute of Islamic studies which researches the response of religion to social, political and economic problems.
We are the youngest Islamic activists from Nahdlatul Ulama background. Yeah. But we may be different from our orang tua.
Seniors.
Yeah. We have a program to introduce the variety of thought and maybe the extreme of thought on Islam, especially issues of a human right, equality between men and women, democratization of political life in Indonesia. Maybe it's different with our seniors, but it's not a rejection of our seniors. Not rejection, but it's the interpretation.
Sometimes the interpretation support the interest of the group that interpret the Quran. And we know that all of the our Quran interpretation come from the Middle Age of Islam. And now we live in another time. We need a new interpretation of the Quran. In our opinion, the old interpretation about the Quran always put the people
as a servant to the king. In Javanese, it's kaulo. So in Indonesia, the important thing is to democratize the political life by reinterpreting Al-Quran or interpreting fiqh.
The young activists of LKIS disseminate their ideas about the task of reinterpreting traditional Islamic texts through training courses, workshops, and a vigorous publishing program.
This is an example book published. Imam Shafi'i, Moderatism, Eclecticism, and Arabism. This book is criticized system of thought Imam Shafi'i, the founder of Shafi'i school of Islamic law.
It is very influential in Indonesia.
Imam Shafi'i is yes. very influential in Indonesia, but this book is criticizes him. It is masyarakat tak bernegara, community without state. That is a critic for Islamic political theory. It is the tradisi kemodernan dan metamodernisme, tradition, modernity, and metamodernism. It is a collection of writing about Muhammad Arkonsod, Muslim singers, philosophers from Algiers, but now he teach in Sorbonne University. It is the deconstruction of Sharia Part 2.
Lots of deconstruction.
Halo, selamat siang. Dengan Ibu Sari.
Ibu Sari di mana?
Taru.
Ibu Sari has a problem, so she phones a popular TV talk show. The government says the talk shows go too far in their choice of topics, but today the phone calls are conventional. The guest problem solver is Wada Hafiz. Tell me about Ibu Sari's problem.
It's a problem of neighbors. The husband of her neighbor is the subordinate of her husband. And this wife many times come to her and force her to buy things from her. And Ibu Sari couldn't say no. So that she had to buy things that she didn't need actually. And so at the end, she forced her husband to move from the complex, from the housing complex, in order to avoid the problem. So when we talk about it, I told her that she had to be firm and tell the neighbor to draw a line between office, business, and individual. I mean, it is a case where one doesn't know, you know, the limit of the private and public spheres.
Wada Hafiz is an activist who focuses on women and Islam. From her perspective, the so-called 80s accommodation between the government and Islam has given rise to a growing neo-conservatism in Islam, which in turn has negative impacts on women.
Used to be that in Indonesia we have a more or less free space to move. I mean, we can work outside the house, we can go wherever we want without any religious restriction. Since I think late 80s or early 90s, when there is this growing tendency of neoconservatism, people started to talk about the ideal of women being a good mother and stay at home and, you know, give up working outside the house. Second thing is things related to marriage and sex issues, in which people or men started to talk about polygamy is acceptable because it's in accordance with Islam, you know. Then people started talking about women should not be in the leadership position. The religion says that it should be men who should be leaders, you know. All those things limit women's position.
A scholar, Islamic scholars, they think very, very modern in everything, in politics, in economics. And when the discussion is come to women, they become very conservative. And they say, this is from the West. And I said, when you talk about the banking system, this is from the West. And you don't have any problem with that, it's from the West. But when it's come to women, and they suddenly say that, No, we can accept this because this is from the West. I can conclude that this is actually the effect of the religious socialization in the family. It's very difficult to change.
Ruhaini teaches at a Muhammadiyah university and is the first and only female member of Muhammadiyah's Majlis. That's the body which issues statements on Islamic law, fiqh. For Ruhaini also, interpretation is the key.
Yeah, this is actually the key for me to really read by myself in the Arabic literature, and it's really helped me to come with the new interpretation. Something that I did with my women colleagues in my faculty is when most of the Islamic preachers in Islamic teachers say that the household affairs is really the responsibility of women. And then I went to the library. I found it's a very tiny book, and it's a very easy book to read. And in one of the page, I saw that all the household affairs is not women's responsibility. This is male responsibility as part of the family support, because in Islam, the family support should go to the husband, it's not to the wives. And then I came to my male colleagues and I said, what did you do with this? And I said, you hide this for 400 years. And I said, look, Aini, this is not suitable for our society. You have to wait until they can understand, because if it is not, you get in trouble in the society. I said, wait a minute, because I have to speak out this, because this is a misconception in our society that women always kept in the house because of Islamic teaching. But I found that it is not. This is our cultural perspective in seeing the role of women, actually. So this is the benefit of mastering Arabic for me.
Women are striking voices in contemporary Indonesian Islam. Educated women committed to the idea that change can and must be achieved from within an Islamic religious framework. In Yogyakarta, Masruha is a leader among young NU activists. She works with an organization called LKPSM, Institute for Developing Human Resources. One thing they do is go to Pazantren, traditional Islamic schools that have been the backbone of Islamic formation and development. They teach about law, leadership, improving economic skills, all from a gender perspective. Do you find that girls respond to what you have to say? Are they very interested?
Pertama kali shock mereka. Shock gitu kan?
For the first time, they shocked to remember what LKPM say about Mas Ruha say about the equality between men and women. But after that, they eager to deconstruct and deconstruct again all of the basic principle in Islam, especially the relationship between men and women.
Pribadi perempuan, pribadi laki-laki, kemudian relasi yang adil itu bagaimana?
Sidik-sidik kitab-kitab sidik-sidik ini.
I went with Masruha to the Pazantren Al Imam.
They want to teach the basic values in the Quran, and then when they go home, she hope they're applying the basic values from the Quran to the community.
The religious teacher and leader was in this case a woman. Such a person is called a Nyai. The Nyai spoke only Javanese. Her son translated into Bahasa Indonesian.
Okay. If someone want to be a Kiai or the Nyai, he must master in Islamic teaching, and the community must acknowledge him. As you know, that there are many people who knows about Islam, but the community not acknowledge him.
Yeah, injing maus Al Quran, and siang esas.
In the morning, they memorizing the Quran, and after that they go to the school, attend the school. 7 o'clock in the evening, they memorizing the Quran again. they memorizing the Quran until 9 o'clock. Some of them memorizing the Quran until late the night to read in front of the nyai in the tomorrow morning to show to the nyai that they have memorized some of the verses from the Quran. This is Al Kafirun Surah, in English, unbeliever.
Terima kasih.
I said thank you.
It was chastening. But as I found out, it's always a matter of interpretation.
About unbeliever, yes.
They did that on purpose.
It's just spontaneous.
Spontaneous,
yeah.
Because they saw in front of them a kafir.
Because no. Popular surahs in
popular surah. Yes. In the surah said that for you, your religion, yes. And for me,
my religion. Yes.
Sometime the Muslim said that this is the basis for tolerance. Tolerance.
Yes.
Just for you, your religion, and just for me, my religion. Mm. The title of the surah is the Unbeliever.
It's song Nabi. It's song Nabi Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam from Saudi Arabia. You understand? Reading the book of Kitab Al-Quran.
There are many people who helped with this program. Thank you to everyone. Technical production, Neil Hobbs. I'm Margaret Coffey.
You check car. You check taxi.
My picture. You send here. Yes. With security. Okay. Yes.